Listener supported. WNYC Studios.
Brian Lehrer on WNYC. Thanks so much for listening today. The Arab Spring got a cold blast of reality in Syria yesterday when President Bashar al-Assad gave a speech to Parliament that made no concessions to the protesters calling for reform.
Syria today is the object of a major conspiracy, a plot whose threads go back to many countries. This plot is based on what's happening in other Arab states.
It was a conspiracy. It was a plot. Assad, through a translator, obviously, expectations had been high after a couple of his aides had dropped hints that he would announce an end in this speech to emergency law, which was put in place in Syria in 1963. Instead, as you heard there, he blamed outside conspirators for the protests. Today, he did form a committee to report back to him on the possibility of eventually abolishing the laws, perhaps by next month. But to talk more about the situation in Syria and the culture there and whether the U.S. can impact the democracy movement there in any way, I'm joined by Bobby Ghosh, Deputy International Editor for Time Magazine, and Krista Salamandra, Lehman College Anthropology Professor, who specializes in Syrian popular culture. Welcome to WNYC, Professor Salamandra, and welcome back, Bobby Ghosh.
Anytime. Thanks, man.
Thanks for having me.
So President Assad actually made the point in his speech that we've heard from callers. All these countries experiencing protests are different. Bobby Ghosh, who are the protesters in Syria? Are they the Facebook generation that was so much on display in Egypt? Are they members of a particular tribe or faction of the Sunni majority protesting the minority Shiite rulers? Who are they?
Well, it started out as a mirror image of what we've seen in other parts of the Arab world. These were, as you call them, the Facebook generation that was inspired by what they saw in Tunisia, in Egypt, and began to plan protests in Syria. Since then, the thing has taken on a slightly different color. Various resentments that were long simmering have come to flower within this movement. And yes, there are a lot of people who represent the Sunni majority and resent the fact that the country is run by a relatively small Shiite sect.
Now, in a tightly controlled country like Syria, gauging reaction to the speech can be difficult. I've read translations of very pro-Assad comments where he's praised for showing strength and not giving in to, quote, extremist radicals, and then reactions showing disappointment that no reforms were offered. Professor Salamandra, where do you look to find real reactions from Syrians?
Well, my sense is that reactions have been very varied, but that there was an overriding sense of disappointment. But one thing that I want to add about the sort of nature of the protests is something new that we're seeing in Syria, which is a new openness towards talking about sectarianism and a broad anti-sectarian sentiment, which I think is also emerging in relation to the cautionary tale of Iraq.
You want to go a little deeper into that?
Well, I think that there is a great fear of civil war, and the fault lines are, if not quite the same as they were in Iraq, quite similar. You have a broad sectarian mix. You have a regime that is associated with a minority sect, and I think people are very afraid of civil war and want to balance their calls for reform with a dampening down of sectarian sentiments.
Now, I think we have a caller who wants to address exactly that point. So let's go right there right now. Charles in Manhattan, you're on WNYC. Hello. All right, Charles, we'll get back to you later. Listen, anybody who calls, please listen on the phone, not on the radio, so you don't get confused by the delay. Bobby Ghosh, the president of Syria is the son of the last president, Hafez al-Assad, who ruled for almost 30 years. Bashar was studying to be an ophthalmologist in London when his older brother died and he became the heir apparent. He was initially seen as a reformer, or at least a potential reformer with some Western values, who then got stymied by the old guard from his father's day. Is that perception dead now?
I think that's long dead. It's questionable whether he was stymied by his father's old guard. That's a very convenient excuse. I think once he came to power, there is a case to be made that he simply followed his father's footsteps. And there is indication that that he feels that's the correct way to rule, that Syria needs to be run by a man with an iron fist. The expectations of reform disappeared quite early. He certainly talked the good talk. The fact that he was young and that he had lived most of his life in the West, the fact that he had not been expected to be his father's successor, his elder brother, had died suddenly, which thrust the crown upon him, so to speak. All those things led people in Syria and around the region, I think, to place more hope and faith in him than now, looking back, he deserved. People were projecting onto him their expectations, but that disappeared within a few years of his taking power. This is not to say he hasn't delivered a certain amount of economic success. Syria is better off today in many ways than it has been some years ago when he took over. It's certainly doing better than some of its neighbors. And there is a class of wealthy Syrians, the elite, that has emerged. Most of these people have connections to the ruling class in some way. There is a high degree of corruption, of nepotism. But some boats have risen. So I don't think that he is a Gaddafi-like figure. He's certainly not someone like Mubarak, who was widely disliked by his own people. There is a sizable proportion. It's impossible to know how much exactly, because, of course, you can't get people have difficulty speaking freely in Syria. But there is a sizable proportion of the Syrian population that actually likes Bashar Assad and would like to see him stay president. They would also like some more freedoms, but they don't necessarily want regime change.
Listeners, any Syrians or Syrian Americans happen to be listening this morning? If so, give us a call and tell us what you are hoping for with respect to the democracy movement in the Middle East as it arrives in Syria. 212-433-WNYC, 433-9692, or post to WNYC.org. Click on Brian Lehrer Show and tell everybody else in the audience what they should know about Syria or Syrians that they never thought to ask. Any Syrians out there? 212-433-WNYC, 433-9692. Let's try Charles in Manhattan again. Hi, Charles. You're on the air.
Yes. Good morning, Brian Lehrer. Two things. One is that, contrary to one of your guests, unfortunately, the situation appears to be evolving in Syria does tend to highlight the sectarian variable. A lot of people, after the initial demonstrations in the south, which did have a somewhat Sunni Islamicist tenor. So you had, for example, signs denouncing Iran, signs denouncing Hezbollah, who are both, of course, allies of the current regime in Syria. The reaction of that, of a lot of Alawites and even some Christians, was to highlight their regime, meaning Ba'athist identity. So you had a whole bunch of people on their Facebook pages having the president's picture on it. And this was an evolving dynamic of the last couple of weeks.
Charles, thank you. So, Professor Salamandra, I think that goes to your point from before.
Yes, but I would say that the reaction to those movements were broad calls to anti-sectarianism, particularly in Latakia.
The reaction to the, in other words, documenting a sectarian division in Syria. This is about my group versus your group. And you're saying there was a reaction to tamp that down?
Yes.
Which was?
which were broad calls to anti-sectarianism, to shared Syrian identity, to shared sense of citizenship. And those actually also paralleled what happened in Egypt with Muslims and Christians praying together at late in the protests.
And Professor, you're an expert in Syrian popular culture, which is not something that many Americans think about. They think about a closed, repressive, you know, Ba'athist society, very conservative, not a place where you would think of popular culture if you're an American. What is big in Syrian popular culture, and how does it deal with politics?
What is big in Syrian popular culture is the television drama industry, which is actually the subject of my forthcoming book. And it is an industry that tackles a broad range of issues. I think most of when we do hear about it in the West, we hear about some rather nostalgic, folkloric costume dramas that they do, but they also tackle all the same issues that the protesters have raised, actually. The winners and losers of the neoliberal reforms, government corruption, sectarian issues. So all of these sort of hot issues that the protesters are calling for change around have actually been talked about in Syrian drama for at least 10 years.
Here's a Syrian American calling in. Crudo in Brooklyn, you're on WNYC. Hello.
Hi. I'm sorry, I can't use my real name because I have family back in Syria, but I'm a Syrian Kurd from Qamishli.
You're a Syrian Kurd, uh-huh.
Mm-hmm. And I want also to talk about sectarianism and why the Kurds haven't joined the protests yet in Syria.
Go ahead.
And the thing is, in 2004, there was a sort of an uprising in the northeast in Syria, in Qamishli, which is the biggest Kurdish city in the country. And what happened back then is that the apparatus of the regime, they killed about 30 people. And also afterward, they used the sectarian ticket, they used some Arab tribes against the Kurds. And so, of course, it became more people against people. And so now, lots of people are asking the same question. And me, one of them, why the Kurds haven't joined the uprising this time yet. And the thing is, many of the Kurds in the north are afraid that if they move, and they have been threatened through the regime threatened the people, that if they move, there would be sectarian violence.
Right. Crudo, thank you very much. And Bobby Ghosh, I think that's a really important insight considering history. Bashar al-Assad's father faced protests from the Muslim Brotherhood and other Sunni groups in the late 70s, and it culminated in a massacre on Hama in 1982, where numbers vary. I think the minimum that people say is they killed upwards of 10,000 civilians. And I wonder what part that history is playing in dampening the willingness to participate among Kurds, as our caller says, or anyone else aware of 1982.
I think that plays a very big part, Brian. I think the big difference you see across the Arab world where revolutions have been successful, so Tunisia and Egypt, and where revolutions have not yet been successful, is that in the latter case, you have countries that have a record, a history of state forces essentially slaughtering large numbers of people in their recent history, and that's what you see in Syria. Egypt, for all its corruption and all the misrule of Mubarak, there was no record of the Egyptian army or the Egyptian security forces ever killing hundreds, never mind thousands of Egyptians in any one incident. Likewise, Tunisia, whereas in countries like Iran, there is a history of that. In Syria, there's a history of that. And, of course, we're seeing that unfold even as we speak in Libya. So Syrians are very conscious of the fact that they cannot, unlike the Egyptians or the Tunisians, they cannot expect their military to stand by their side when the chips are down. They know that the armed forces will side with the government, will side with Assad.
We're talking about Syria with Bobby Ghosh from Time and Krista Salamandra from Lehman College. And here is a Lebanese-American, and Syria is very influential in Lebanon. That's one of the reasons that the U.S. is interested in Syria. It's kind of ties with Hezbollah. That's one of the reasons Israel is interested in Syria. It's ties with Hezbollah in Lebanon. Joe in Harrisburg, you're on WNYC. Hi, Joe. Thank you so much for calling.
Yeah, good afternoon. My concern is for Israel's security, Israel is the number one player in the Middle East, and as long as it is not secure with the presence of this triangle of terror from Hezbollah and Iran and Assad, if one of these pillars of terrorism, they fall, then there'll be a greater chance of lasting peace in the Middle East, because we Lebanese are also fed up with Hezbollah. They do nothing. They bully everybody around. So Lebanon is not getting anywhere. With so much entrepreneurial spirit and all that, we are still in the doldrums.
Joe,
so
thank
if
you.
One of these pillars fall, it will be great for everlasting peace in the Middle East.
Thank you for your call. And, Bobby, I'll stay with you on this. How much do you think Lebanese in general feel the way Joe does? Certainly one of the times that Syria hit the news in this country in the last few years was over the assassination of an elected Lebanese president, and Syria got most of the blame. And Hezbollah has grown in strength since then. And there's, of course, the relationship with Iran, which is also connected to Hezbollah, that Syria also has. So do you think the Lebanese are rooting for change in Syria? And could the democracy movement in Syria, if it does flourish, and even if it is sectarian in nature, could that loosen Syria's grip on the people of Lebanon?
Well, there are some big ifs in there, Brian, but on the whole, I suspect that the majority of Lebanese would be rooting for change in Syria. If you ask the support of Hezbollah, not so much, but Hezbollah is not a majority party. It doesn't even enjoy, I don't think, a substantial plurality. It is the nature of Lebanese politics. It is so fractured and so sectarian that even without a majority, Hezbollah is able to, in a political way, punch way above its weight class. But outside of Hezbollah, I think most Lebanese, especially young Lebanese, would like to see change, not just in Syria, but across their region. But if it looks like they could get change in Syria, they'd certainly be rooting for that.
Speaking of popular culture, by the way, Professor, and you're an expert in popular culture in Syria, did you see the profile of the Syrian First Lady in the January issue of Vogue? And given what has happened in the world, I wonder if it comes off a bit tone deaf.
Yes, indeed. I think it was an unfortunate choice and even more unfortunate timing on the part of Vogue. I understand the impulse behind it. The impulse was to put a human face on a place that has been vilified in the Western media. But I think they chose the wrong humans to do that. And I think that there are many other wonderful human interest stories like Syrian drama that could be evoked to do that task, and stories that would have fit the requisite glamour. I mean, you have basically the Hollywood of the Middle East is now in Syria, so that could have been a wonderful feature story.
Yeah. And we'll see that in your book, I presume. But Bobby, before you go, the U.S. is obviously getting very involved in Libya and their anti-Qaddafi movement. And we heard the speech from President Obama the other night where he said basic American values were at stake when we saw slaughter taking place. What about Syria? Do you think the United States has any interest in encouraging the democracy movement there, the anti-Assad movement there? And, you know, what if the shootings of protesters by the government worsen?
Well, does the U.S. have an interest? Yes, I think the Western world, or the world at large, has an interest. But it's a game that would have to be played much more surreptitiously. As we've seen in other parts of the region, the U.S. expresses too much support for a group. That group is actually weakened, rather than strengthen. It allows the administration to paint that group as a bunch of traitors, as stool pigeons for the West, and so on and so forth. So I'm sure there are people in the Obama administration who are working even now to develop contacts with the pro-democracy movement in Syria, and there may be ways to use. Since we've described these people as the Facebook generation, there are ways to use that technology to strengthen those connections. But given the fact that the Obama administration has its hands full with several of these in Yemen, in Bahrain, and elsewhere, I think they'll probably be doing it very, very cautiously.
Bobby Ghosh, deputy. Go ahead, Professor.
No, I actually just think we have to be very careful not to delegitimize the protests by involvement.
Exactly.
Bobby Ghosh, Deputy International Editor for Time Magazine, Krista Salamandra, Lehman College Anthropology Professor, who specializes in Syrian popular culture. What's your book going to be called? When does it come out?
Hopefully sometime next year, and it's entitled Waiting for Light.
Thank you so much for joining us, both of you.
Thank you for having me.
Thanks for having me.
Brian Lehrer on WNYC. Coming up next, should you really be concerned about those food dyes and your kids' health? How about colorless Cheetos? Saw that article, right? Clear Jell-O, all of that. Is that what we need to do to stop our kids from getting hyper? We will try to find out.